and welcome to another episode of Free Lunch by the Peak, the podcast where we talk to people way smarter than us about the most important topics in Canadian business, economics, and policy. I'm your co-host, Taylor Scollin.
And I'm Sarah Brett-Nika.
So Sarah, how much do you know about the battery in your smartphone?
Embarrassingly little. And any time that I encounter a problem, there's some very helpful geniuses at the Apple store who help me out with it and then send me on my way so I can just not think about it again. What about you?
Yeah, about the same. But you know, we spend so much time writing about batteries and covering the battery supply chain in the context of renewables and clean energy transition and all this sort of stuff. But I really don't know much about how batteries actually work and the innovation that's happening.
A few chapters because we are writing a lot about EV batteries specifically, but it feels like we're missing some of the basics.
I definitely feel like I'm missing some of the fundamentals. And you know, I do have some sense of what's going on with the economics of it, but the technical side of it, I'm completely out to sea.
100%. I feel the same.
So I thought today would be a good opportunity to try and at least begin to solve that problem. I don't expect us to become battery experts over the course of one podcast episode, but we can at least
try.
We can get started. We can start the work that we skipped in our science education. And we have a fantastic guest on to patiently help us do that. Dr. Michael Metzger is the Hertzberg Don Chair in Advanced Battery Research at Dalhousie University, where he is an assistant professor. He's also one of the three principal investigators in the Dalhousie Tesla Research Partnership on long-lived, high-energy density and low-cost batteries. Dr. Michael Metzger, thank you so much for joining us on Free Lunch.
Yeah, hi Taylor and Sarah, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So can we start out with a high-level overview of what you're working on at the Canadian Battery Innovation Center and what the objective of this institution is?
Yeah, sure. I would be happy to talk about that. You know, so we envision the Canadian Battery Innovation Center to be a high-quality prototyping center for new battery technologies, and that will be located in Halifax, Nova Scotia at Dalhousie University. And, you know, we want to make it an accessible facility really for anybody who wants to prototype their materials or cell technologies that can help us develop better batteries. And so that would be, you know, colleagues from academia, but also folks from industry who develop new materials or battery cells. So it's really a user facility for new battery materials and new processing technologies.
And what is the gap, I guess, in the marketplace that it's filling? Like, how does innovation like this usually happen, and how are you maybe approaching it differently?
Yeah, you know, maybe I should say what we currently do here at the university. You know, so I'm an assistant professor who is working with two other professors in a research partnership with Tesla. And, you know, we do work on all aspects of battery technology, really. So, you know, we have several goals that we set together with Tesla. And, you know, our colleagues in Canada who work at other universities, they oftentimes also have industry partners and work towards, you know, improving battery technology. And then, of course, there's innovation that's happening in the private sector, right, where folks are developing better batteries, you know, at various companies along the value chain. And I think what's lacking at the moment, at least here in Canada, is sort of an institution that bridges this gap between academia and industry, right, that helps to bring innovations that we make in the laboratory to the Canadian battery industry.
What are some of the specific goals that Tesla is interested in pursuing alongside you guys?
Yeah, so together with Tesla, which is sort of, you know, kind of our current framework in which we work, and that's independent of the Battery Innovation Center. Together with Tesla, we work on lowering the cost of battery technology, improving the energy density so that, you know, batteries can store more energy and enable longer driving ranges. And then we also work on the safety of lithium-ion batteries. We want to make them, the new materials that we develop, at least as safe as the sort of current materials that are used in battery cells. And then a very big focus of ours is also the sustainability of battery cells. So we want to use very abundant elements in batteries so that, you know, there is no harmful sort of impact on the environment when materials for battery cells are mined.
So the batteries that we're talking about here, I'm guessing, are not like the, you know, AA batteries that you put in remote control. What sort of batteries are you working on, and what purpose do they have? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's a really good point, Taylor, because, you know, we call that the form factor in the battery world, basically. So, you know, what's the type of battery that you work on? And oftentimes, you know, researchers in academia, like us also, we work with very small battery cells on the laboratory scale. So we call them coin cells. Sometimes they're called button cells. So they are really small and contain about, you know, less than a gram of active material. So active material is the material that stores lithium ions on the positive side and on the negative side of the battery, right? And then there's sort of a liquid electrolyte, a liquid solution that allows the lithium ions to flow between the positive and the negative electrode. So these coin cells, they are great, you know, for developing new materials. You know, for example, we synthesize a few grams of these active materials in our laboratory. We put them into a coin cell and we can charge and discharge the cell and see how good our new material works. But of course, you know, folks in industry are interested in real prototype batteries. So that would be larger cells that contain more active material and are in a realistic form factor that you can actually use in an application. And there you have three options: pouch cells, that's cells that are packaged in sort of a flexible material. We call that pouch foil. And then we have cylindrical battery cells. So for example, Tesla is using a lot of cylindrical cells in their products. And then you have prismatic cells, which are sort of larger steel case cells. These are the common form factors. So going back to the Battery Innovation Center, the point is really, you know, to not only develop materials at the small laboratory scale, but being able to scale that up and bring those novel materials into real, realistic formats and real, realistic form factors.
So what are the... Where's the innovation happening, I guess? Like when you're talking about the very small batteries that you're working on in the lab, what parameters are you adjusting? What sort of changes are you making? And what are you trying to achieve?
Yeah. So we're, you know, exploring a lot of things around these general themes that I mentioned in the beginning, you know, things like cost, energy density, safety, and so on, right? So the way we do this is, you know, what we tweak is sort of the composition, as we say, or also called the cell chemistry of the battery. So classical example is, for example, is the sort of nickel-rich positive electrode, which is heavily researched at the moment in academia. So that would be a positive electrode material, which contains about 80 to 90% nickel. Some of the other elements are manganese or cobalt, right? And so these are oxide type materials, and they can store lithium between, you know, the layers of these oxide sheets. And, you know, nickel is, of course, also used for many other industries. And when you look at sort of the ramp up of battery production in the future, then sure, these materials are great for like high performing battery cells in long range cars. But you know, when you want to make cheaper cars that are suitable for the mass market, maybe you want to move away from these nickel rich materials. So we develop other positive electrode materials that, for example, are based on iron and manganese. And they can be much cheaper. They store less energy, sure, but they can be cheaper, more sustainable. And we, for example, test how we can improve those materials, those novel materials, and how we can also sort of improve the lifetime of batteries that use these various materials. So we really tweak the atoms, I would say, in the active materials. So we really work on the materials level in our battery work.
Okay. And if, you know, the example that you gave, like the nickel versus the iron, mm-hmm. what sort of cost savings can you achieve by changing the materials that are being used there? Or do you hope to achieve, maybe, if you haven't already?
I mean, when it comes to cost, that's always a little difficult for us to say as university researchers, you know, because, okay. I mean, ultimately, we're not the ones to make the product and then really sell it with sort of a suitable right. margin, right? But, you know, in terms of the raw material costs, you know, nickel, lithium, these are the elements that can be quite expensive in lithium-ion batteries. And then if you move to something like manganese, iron, these are just much more abundant elements that are cheaper. Mm. And, you know, we are also concerned about the sort of volatile cost structure of lithium. And there you could develop battery cells that are based on sodium. And that's a new technology that's sort of completely lithium-free. And then you also have a very abundant element for sort of the mobile ion in the battery. And these sodium ion batteries can also lead to quite a lot of cost reduction of battery cells.
You mentioned the three different types of batteries, mm-hmm. the pouch battery, the prismatic, mm-hmm. and the other one, which the name you'll need to remind me of. What is the difference between those and why do you use different forms mm-hmm. of batteries like that?
Yeah, the third one is a cylindrical cell. And that's actually a really good question, because... I mean, folks in industry are all the time figuring out what is the best battery cell for the product that they want to make, right? So in batteries, it's really about packing as much energy as you can in as tight a space as possible, okay? So that's what we call volumetric energy density, the watt hours of energy per liter of volume. So you can imagine in a car, for example, if that's the product you want to electrify, there is only a finite volume that you can work with. Oftentimes, it's sort of the floor below the seats, right, in passenger cars. Mm. And you need to do that while maintaining safety, right? Because, of course, as you pack a lot of energy into a small volume, right, there is also risks of releasing that energy in an uncontrolled way, right? When you have fires or other safety incidents, right? So different materials lend themselves to different form factors. So remember that nickel-rich oxide material that I was talking about that is high in energy density can enable long driving ranges. You know, this is a material that's nice for a cylindrical cell because these cylindrical cells are small, small little cylinders. Okay. They also come in different diameters and different heights, but they are much smaller overall than these large prismatic sort of bricks. Okay. These large steel, cased cells. So, you know, you want to put those high energy density materials like the nickel rich oxide materials into smaller cells, because if one cell has a failure, it's not as dramatic as if a large prismatic cell has a failure. Whereas the iron-based materials that are a little lower in energy density, they lend themselves very well to these larger form factors where you can pack a lot of active material into a large prismatic cell. So it's really a game of trade-offs, I would say, and you have to find the optimal solution for your material and your application.
Battery development feels pretty new still. And I'm wondering if you could like walk us through like where we are on like the spectrum of like innovation to kind of like situate us in time. Like mm-hmm. how far have we come? What have been like those key moments? And like, do you know how far we can still go in terms of improving these batteries?
Yeah, you know, the battery field is really quite interesting and super fast paced, I would say. But, you know, the battery that we now use in our cell phones and actually also the sort of the fundamental concept of the battery that we are using in our electric vehicles, that has been commercialized in 1991 by Sony. So that's more than 30 years ago. And the 2019 Nobel Prize in Chemistry was given for that invention. So invention of the lithium-ion battery. So it has quite a history. And of course, you know, before it was successfully commercialized, there has been a lot of research, you know, starting from the 50s, 60s, really, where people were trying to make these energy storage devices, right, that we now call batteries. So there's quite a long history of the lithium-ion battery, but the field is still evolving very, very rapidly. Okay, so, you know, over the years, of course, you know, scientists and engineers have tried to make the batteries contain more energy, be cheaper, be safer, the same goals that we still have. And nowadays, I would say there are a few interesting research thrusts that the field is evolving into. So there is something, for example, that people call beyond lithium batteries, okay? So that can be sodium ion batteries or potassium ion batteries, so batteries that no longer use any lithium. I mentioned the liquid electrolyte solution that's between the positive and the negative electrode. Another stream in our field is to make that a solid. That would be the solid state batteries, or sometimes called all solid state batteries. They have the promise of being safer and higher in energy density. And then another concept is also to move away from this intercalation chemistry, as we say, so where you put lithium between the different layers, as I explained for this nickel-rich oxide material. Then you talk about conversion batteries, okay? There you have not this insertion reaction on the positive and the negative electrode, but you completely convert your material into a different chemical species. That is, for example, the case for so-called lithium sulfur or lithium oxygen batteries. So the field is evolving and is very exciting and very diverse. And there's still very much research to do.
I'm going to ask a really dumb question. How does a battery hold energy?
It's not such a dumb question. I mean, it's basically the intercalation concept that was awarded with the Nobel Prize in 2019. So, you know, folks in the 80s have figured that out, how to realize that for the positive and the negative electrode. So for the positive electrode, you use, you know, a material much like the one that I described, where you have sort of layers of metal oxide sheets. It can be cobalt oxide or nickel oxide. And in between these layers, you can put lithium ions and they stay there. They are in an energetically stable state. And in the negative electrode, you can use a material which is called graphite. So that's just a carbon-based material. You find it in your pencil also. Okay, so these are sheets of carbon layers. And you can also stuff your lithium between those sheets. And if you have all your lithium in the positive electrode, so between the layers of the metal oxide material, and the negative electrode is empty, the graphite sheets are empty, the lithium is in a higher energy state, so it stores a lot of energy. And then you can discharge that energy by moving all the lithium over into the graphite negative electrode. And then it stays there. And it does that voluntarily, right? Because it wants to lower its energy state. And that's the energy you discharge from the battery. But now when you want to move the lithium back into the positive electrode, you need to apply a current. You need to put energy into the battery, right? That's what you do on charge. So that's how the battery stores energy. You make suitable host sites for your mobile ion, which is lithium in most cases.
Okay, we're ready to start making batteries.
We're ready. Yeah. Is that the same way that the battery in my phone works?
Yeah, that's exactly the same way. So in your phone, you use graphite, the material that I mentioned for the negative electrodes. And for the positive electrode, you use lithium cobalt oxide. So that's a material which contains the lithium in the beginning, right? And then you have cobalt as your transitional metal element and oxygen as your other element in the battery. That's really all of it, just three elements, lithium, cobalt, and oxygen in the positive electrode. And interestingly, that's the exact same combination of active materials that was commercialized by Sony in 1991, and we're still using it in smartphones.
So in terms of your research, is any of it informed by, you know, you read a lot about raw material shortages and, mm-hmm. And whether we're going to have enough of these materials that kind of make up these batteries. Is there any research that stems from you mentioned that what are the materials beyond lithium, but I wonder how does a perceived shortage mm-hmm. or worries about supply inform your research at all?
Yeah, another really great point. And, you know, we think about these questions a lot because ultimately we want to develop battery cells that can be massively scaled, because think about the sheer scale of batteries you need in the future, right? If you want to electrify all cars and if you have more renewables on the grid, maybe we'll talk about that later. But to your questions about, you know, research shortages, and sometimes it's even just a perceived shortage, right? So there are a few elements that are, I would say, critical along the battery supply chain. And a prime example is cobalt. Okay, so yes, it's used in our smartphones, but you know, the smartphone battery is very small, a few amp hours of capacity, as we say. And that's negligible compared to the size of a battery you use for an electric vehicle, right? So sure, we can power all of our smartphones with cobalt-based lithium-ion batteries, but we can no longer use that technology for electric vehicles. So cobalt is particularly challenging in terms of its supply chain because almost all of the cobalt comes from the Democratic Republic of Congo. A lot of child labor is involved in the mining process, and it's quite high in price. So we want to move away from it. So now researchers like us, we need to develop so-called cobalt-free batteries that can still work very, very well, right? And, you know, that's a particular challenge we're working on. Then take the nickel-rich batteries that I mentioned. You know, that might be a great product for a premium electric vehicle. But as we move to electrifying lower-cost vehicles for the mass market, we need to develop cheaper battery technologies because, you know, nickel is also quite expensive. But then when we talk about real supply shortages, then you are talking about things like lithium or elements like lithium, right? Because it takes about 17 years for a new lithium mine to become online, right? A lot of the lithium is segregated in Chile, Colombia, Bolivia, a little bit in Australia. So it's not a widely distributed resource that you can just scale up through the production very, very rapidly, right? It's also a lot of wastewater is associated with lithium mining. So it's really a question of how much lithium can you refine in order to support that really rapid growth of the battery industry. And we believe you need to develop an alternative technology, like, for example, the sodium ion battery, right? Just so that you can meet that demand. It's not necessarily about really how much lithium we have. It's more of a perceived shortage, right? How much lithium can we refine and get ready in time?
Some of the alternatives that you mentioned, or I suppose the more innovative technologies that mm-hmm. could power these batteries, how far along in development are they? Like, has the concept been proven, but they, you know, aren't in mass production yet? Or do you still need to work through how the technology will actually mm-hmm. work? Like, where are we at in that development cycle?
Yeah. So I'll answer that for a few of the material classes I mentioned. So for example, these nickel-rich battery chemistries, they are already in our products. And for us, the challenge is, how can we enable these battery technologies that are so high in energy density with a very long battery lifetime, right? That's oftentimes the trade-off. Okay, you get great driving range, but maybe your battery in the car degrades too fast. Okay, so we try to solve those questions for those nickel-rich materials. And then you go to those lower-cost materials like the iron-based batteries I mentioned, for example. They are also already in products. But now you have other problems you need to tackle, okay? Like I mentioned, their energy density is lower. So how can you tweak those materials a little bit to have more competitive energy densities, right? So we add other elements to the positive electrode and improve the materials in this way. And this is ongoing research. And, you know, there's lots of opportunity for improvement there. Then the lithium-free batteries, the sodium-ion batteries, they are a more early-stage technology, which is not quite ready for prime time yet, I would say. So there are makers of this battery technology, mostly in Asia. In fact, 95% of all the sodium-ion batteries that are produced today come from China. And it's sort of unclear what the market case for this battery technology will be. Maybe it will start off with, you know, e-bikes, two-wheelers, which is actually a very sought-after product, especially in Asia, right? You could also think about short-range, maybe city-type electric vehicles, you know, the mini EVs or so, for urban areas. Or you can think about stationary energy storage. That's something we didn't talk about yet, you know, where you use batteries to store wind and solar energy for the electricity grid. There, it doesn't matter so much how much energy you can store per volume, right? So what your energy density is. And these sodium ion batteries, they suffer a little bit from a lower energy density, even a little lower, about 80% of those iron-based batteries. So it's really challenging to use them for vehicles, but they would be very suitable for stationary energy storage.
Interesting. You know, one thing that, this is also kind of a dumb question, I think, but I'm going to ask it anyway, because, you know, when you talk to people in, you know, energy, they'll talk about fusion as this like holy grail source of energy. Is there a, like a holy grail battery technology that people talk about? It's like, oh, if we could just develop this type of battery, all of these problems would be solved.
Yeah, that's a very good question. And, you know, when people talk about nuclear fusion, right, they often say it's 20 years away.
Yeah.
But then, you know, you read a news report a couple years later, or you meet a person a couple years later, and it's still 20 years away. That's the same.
Yeah, I think it's been 20 years away forever, right?
That's the same with a lot of our holy grail battery technology. So, but there is literally, I think, something that is referred to as the holy grail in the battery field. And that is the lithium metal anode, or lithium metal negative electrode. Okay, so I mentioned how our smartphones and most of our cars use graphite as the negative electrode material, but the ultimate negative electrode is lithium, just the metal itself. Okay, because lithium is the lightest element, and it can lead to a really large energy density because it sits at a very low voltage. So, you know, we have discussed the energy difference of the lithium ions when they sit in the positive electrode versus the negative electrode. So if lithium is your negative electrode, they sit at the lowest possible energy. Okay, so you have a large difference between the positive and the negative electrode. So you can release a lot of energy when you discharge that cell. But there come a lot of problems with using lithium metal in your battery. So lithium is a very reactive element. So it reacts very violently with air. It reacts with moisture. It also reacts with the liquid electrolytes you typically use in batteries. So getting that reactivity sort of reined in is very, very difficult. Another challenge is when you charge and discharge your battery and you do it over and over again, you're moving lithium around, right? You're moving lithium between positive and negative electrode. So for the lithium metal electrode, it means you're stripping away lithium from its surface and you plate it again during the charge reaction. So this creates sort of a fresh surface every time, and it never gets really passivated and stable. And then you can even have an issue where little dendrites form. So these are literally like little wires of lithium that can grow over time and touch the positive electrode. And then you have an electrical short circuit along this lithium wire between your positive electrode and your negative electrode. And that's a huge safety hazard, because then you know, the battery can basically discharge through that internal short as opposed to through the external circuit. And that releases all its energy in just, you know, a few seconds, and then it can lead to battery fires. So I would say the lithium metal electrode is a concept that holds great promise. And that's why a lot of folks in academia are working on it. But there are only very few companies that work on it, and it poses a lot of challenges.
So, sorry, for someone who didn't take chemistry past grade 10, what's the difference between the lithium metal electrode that you just described versus the lithium that's already in some of the batteries that we're using? Like, what's the actual difference?
Yeah, that's a great question, because, you know, we call the battery that we're using a lithium ion battery, right? We don't call it a lithium battery.
Which is why I'm confused.
And that's exactly why. So in a lithium ion battery, the only thing that is moving around is lithium in its ionic form, you know, lithium ions. So Li plus, lithium plus ions, you know, there's no metal. There's no lithium metal in it.
Oh, okay.
You just move that little lithium ion between an oxide positive electrode and a graphite negative electrode. It's only that little lithium ion that moves. In fact, it's kind of dumb to call these batteries lithium ion batteries, because lithium by weight, it's negligible. It only makes for a very, very short, very, very small fraction of the entire weight of the battery. It should really be called a nickel battery, right? Or an iron battery, because these are by weight the most represented elements in these batteries, or a cobalt battery in the case of the smartphone, right? So, and the difference between a lithium metal battery and the lithium ion battery is that in a lithium metal battery, you actually have a real sheet of metal on your negative electrode side. So much, much more reactive lithium in that battery.
That makes a lot of sense. That clears a lot of things up, actually. Okay, so that's interesting. Why don't we talk about Canada's opportunity here a little bit? You know, we've seen a lot of policies advanced to build up a battery supply chain here in Canada. I'm curious on your take as to how that's going.
Yeah, I think it's going pretty well, because Canada was ranked the number one country in the battery supply chain, even surpassing China, but that has a lot to do with the higher environmental standards. So it got better ranking. Canada got better rankings in sort of the environmental categories. So, you know, we're pretty well positioned here in Canada to really create a battery success story, I would say. So we have a lot of the critical minerals that are needed to make batteries. We have nickel, we have graphite, we have lithium, we have manganese, iron. So all these elements are readily available, and the mining industry in Canada is very strong. And we also now have quite a lot of battery companies that set up their factories in mostly Ontario and Quebec. So you may have heard about all those big announcements. I'm sure you guys have written about that too. So, you know, Northvolt is an example of a very large battery factory that will be set up in Quebec near Montreal. PowerCo, that's sort of the battery producer for Volkswagen. They are setting up a factory in St. Thomas, Ontario, 90 gigawatt hours. That's gigantic. And then there's LG, Stellantis, a company called Umicore, which makes battery active materials, GM, you know, so there are a lot of companies along the value chain, but most of them are upstream, which would be mining and the materials business, or downstream, which would be the EVs, right? But we don't have so much in the midstream, right? Where all these active materials are refined and, you know, really sort of processed into battery-grade material. So I think that's where Canada can still improve to sort of access the full value chain, which would also, of course, be amazing and a great opportunity for our country.
Are we shipping out materials right now for refinement, or are the upstream producers, like, are they not in action yet?
So, you know, companies like Umicore, they're just setting up that battery materials facility that will be able to process some of our raw materials. And we are definitely exporting a lot of raw materials, yeah, to other countries for sure.
And then we bring them back?
Yeah. Sometimes we literally bring the battery cells back and assemble them in these battery factories to make packs for electric vehicles. Yeah, that's happening.
Okay.
Are there any bottlenecks in the supply chain that we do have? Like, I'm thinking about particular resources or labor, these sorts of things. Mm-hmm. Like, are there things that need to be cleared at some point?
So I think in terms of the resources, we're really very well set up. But labor is a very important issue. You know, so I was at a conference where PowerCo, the company that I mentioned that produces batteries for Volkswagen, mentioned that they currently have 27 employees in St. Thomas, Ontario, but they need 3,000 people for that factory. So do those folks come from, right? And how do we get them trained up in battery technology? And that's the same for many other companies. You know, we have also quite a sort of up-and-coming startup scene here in Nova Scotia with new innovative battery companies. So we have folks like Zen Electric, that's an e-bike company, or Salient Energy. They are producing environmentally friendly zinc ion batteries. So we also have Novonix, which is nowadays a pretty established battery company. They make the graphite negative electrode material, but also high-end battery testing equipment. So, you know, when we talk to leaders from these companies, they often tell us, you know, when are your students graduating? We need, you know, folks. And there is just such a demand for talent in the battery industry that it's almost the most challenging task at the moment to, you know, train enough people to work in all those factories. I don't think it's necessarily too much an issue about having enough raw materials, or, you know, finding, you know, funding to realize all those battery projects. But training enough people and, you know, finding talent is a big challenge for companies for sure.
What sort of education do you need to work in a battery manufacturing factory? Is it like, do you need to be an engineer, or is it more like a skilled trade? Like, what sort of people are they looking for?
Mm-hmm. I mean, it depends, you know, what role you're trying to fill. I mean, we here at the university, our students, they come to us with a bachelor's degree, typically in, you know, chemistry, engineering, physics. And then they have not heard anything about batteries typically, or they have maybe, you know, covered the fundamental science.
What we just learned.
Exactly, that is relevant for batteries in their undergraduate degree. But, you know, then they take master's courses here at the university and learn more about battery technology. They get exposure to how to build actual battery cells in the laboratory. It may be a smaller scale than what they will later encounter in industry, but at least it's a good starting point. And then typically at the master's level, they become very interesting for employers in the battery space, because they had two solid years of training. And that can be, you know, we are located at a physics department here, but you know, a lot of other battery professors work in chemistry or engineering, right? So it's training in physics, chemistry, engineering, material science, these sort of fields. But then also a lot of folks stay around and get a PhD with us. And then, of course, they qualify for sort of roles with more responsibility. But not everybody, of course, needs to have a PhD degree if they want to be useful for the battery industry. I should also say maybe that we're creating a master's program here at the university, which is a dedicated master's in battery technology. So, and that's exactly so that we can output, you know, more as we say, highly qualified personnel, HQP. So more folks with that sort of intense 2 years battery training.
And so I guess you spoke a little bit about the rankings. Were those like the opportunity rankings as far as, because I guess if you look at what we're producing, we would still be behind, I guess, like a country like China. And so I'm wondering, exactly. In terms of in terms of kind of like the short-term runway, right? Like what is the gap, I guess, like from a researcher's point of view, mm-hmm. of like what we would need to do to like actually be competitive despite everyone like getting really excited, mm-hmm. about the opportunity.
Mm. Yeah, as you said, Sarah, we're definitely behind China when it comes to just the, you know, production capacity for battery cells. And, you know, I would say China, South Korea, and Japan are by far the leading countries when it comes to battery production, but it's an opportunity sort of ranking, as you said. You know, that's by Bloomberg, NEF. And this ranking takes into account different factors, but also, you know, the potential of a country for becoming a future leader in the battery supply chain. And I think, you know, definitely something that we are lacking compared to these established countries, China, South Korea, Japan, is just that factory floor experience for making battery cells. You know, these folks have been doing that now for 30 years, right? And that's where a lot of the battery production has been. So, you know, when it comes to building efficient factories with low scrap rates, as we say, you know, so very high production quality, it's really, I would say, challenging to compete with them. And, you know, that's why we need innovation centers like the Canadian Battery Innovation Center, where we can actually, you know, research battery technology at that industrial level, right? And, you know, you might say, well, we want to potentially then just skip ahead and skip that sort of classical lithium-ion battery technology where countries like China are just much stronger, right? But it's sort of unclear if there will be just this breakthrough winner takes it all new battery technology, like, for example, the all-solid-state battery that will dominate the market in the future. So I think Canada definitely needs to catch up in the classical lithium-ion space. And I think it's great that we're seeing all those factories set up or these companies set up factories here in Canada now.
Are we doing the right things? Like, are we investing in catching up, or is there like a part of the industry that is betting on like, oh no, like we'll catch that next wave and we'll just wait for that?
Well, I would say in academia, the US and Canada have always been really, really strong, you know, but then it's just that a lot of those innovations have been commercialized elsewhere, right? And I think now we're realizing, okay, that the battery industry is really, I would say, a strategic industry that we need to have in order to be serious about fighting climate change. You know, in industry, I think we have super innovative companies now. But of course, you know, the Chinese, Japanese, and Koreans have been doing this for so long that they're just much bigger in the sheer scale of production capacity that they have.
Okay, well, I think that is a great place to leave it off. So, Michael, if people want to learn more about the work that you're doing and the Battery Innovation Center, where can they find you?
Yeah, so, you know, they can check out our website. It's metzger-group.com. That has a lot of information about the battery research that we are doing. Yeah, and also they are, you know, welcome to check Dalhousie University, which is the institution that I work for. And there are a lot of other great battery profs over there, you know. So we have folks in engineering, chemistry, and also other professors in physics that do interesting battery work. And it would be cool if our listeners would check it out.
Awesome. All right. Well, thank you, Michael, for doing this. Appreciate you coming on.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Well, Sarah, that was very interesting. I found that I learned a lot.
I learned a lot too.
Yeah.
I hope that there are students listening to this podcast, and it's too late for us, but for them, you know,
they, is it they too? Can, I was thinking about that as Michael was talking. Is it too late for us to get into the battery space?
We talked to so many interesting people that are just at like the cutting edge, yeah, like of their fields and these like emerging fields as well. I was like, if I was listening to this and I was 18,
yeah,
I'd probably sign up for a chemistry class or two.
Yeah, no kidding. I know it's a good episode when at the end I'm like, I want to go do that job. I could never do it though. My science was always terrible.
No, but two weeks ago, we wanted to be, I think, a geopolitical analyst. Yeah, so maybe let's stay focused because we can't build batteries. And
that's right.
Solve.
That's more of a liberal arts career.
Yeah. No, definitely. But I think it's fascinating, kind of just like starting with the basics of this stuff. I know it's not new, but you don't think about the batteries in your phones and like your laptops, which I'm learning that like the real battery hardos, like to them, they're like, oh, your cobalt battery, like that's no, we could just endlessly make those. Like we're actually focused on the bigger picture stuff. And so it was really interesting to hear about where we're kind of at and what Canada is looking at and working on when it comes to producing, I guess, like EV batteries specifically. I'm leaving also very interested in like the other applications too. Like he talked about e-bikes, like that's a thing, you know, in terms of like building batteries that can actually like store energy, like from the grid, like from wind and solar. Like there's so many use cases that I feel like we've barely scraped the surface.
Yeah, no, I thought that would like, I really wanted to keep it focused on the more technical stuff, but you're right. There's a whole episode or series of episodes that we could do just about all of the different applications and like how much we're going to have to scale production of these things.
Now that we know how it works.
Yeah.
We can
know how it works might be a bit of a stretch, but I feel more acquainted at least with the language.
Yeah.
And Michael did a great job explaining it as well as he could for people like us, I think.
Yeah. No, he's an expert. He's one to watch, and what they're doing in their lab as well too. They've been getting a lot of great coverage and good funding. So I'm sure we'll be seeing some announcements out of that lab specifically in the coming months.
Yeah. I mean, it was interesting to hear about the potential that Canada has when it comes to this space, you know, number one in terms of potential, but as I think you pointed out in the interview, still quite a bit of work to do to actually realize all that potential.
Canada's really good at having potential.
Yeah.
As we've learned across all industries.
It's like a gifted kid.
God, there's so much potential here, but can't quite, you know, figure it out. Maybe this will be different because it does seem like we have the pieces in place and we have these big names. I guess at upstream and downstream, Michael mentioned there's just that middle part that we kind of need to figure out too. But it looks like it might be a little bit more than potential at this point, which is positive.
Yeah, very promising. But yeah, I think that's a good place to leave it for now.
I think so too.
All right. Well, this has been another episode of Free Lunch by the Peak. If you enjoyed this, you can find all of our past episodes by searching Free Lunch by the Peak wherever you get your podcasts. And please do leave us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. I really appreciate those. We'll see you next week.